Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and we're looking back into our archives. Gareth talked to Dave Gledhill about flying and fighting the mighty F-4 Phantom FGR-2. He also tells us what the Tornado F-3 really was like, and also the Cold War realities, what it meant for the Western air crews, where a nuclear outcome was always planned for. Enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to Extended, your aerospace radio station. Dave, welcome to Extended. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Gareth.
How are you?
I'm very well. It's a lovely morning.
It is, isn't it? Now, it's not the first time that you and I have sat down for a chat, because we've done a few bits for Global Aviation Resource, but nobody minds talking about Phantoms, do they?
Absolutely right. You know, the standard air crew, you never get fed up of talking about the old aeroplanes.
Yeah. Now, before we have a little chat about what you did with the F-4 particularly, this is my opening gambit, and I've not given you a massive briefing, so I know you're going in quite cold on this.
Sure.
I think most of us would agree that the Phantom is already going to be, you know, is considered an icon, if you like, in the sort of aviation hierarchy. Why do you think that is? What was it, or is it, about the F-4 that has elevated it to such a status?
It's very difficult to say, and it's one of those things that I've pondered. And I suppose the main reason for that is having then switched to the F-3, which was probably all round better than the Phantom in most things that it did, most things. But yet, it didn't have the same charisma. And I think charisma is probably a word that is appropriate in this case. The Phantom somehow was, it was that type of aeroplane that when you flew a sortie, when you climbed out at the end of it, you knew you'd flown a sortie. And it looked after you. It was probably the first of the modern generation of aeroplanes that had quite a good safety record. I say good, I mean, even with its good safety record, we still lost anything up to an aeroplane a month at times during the Cold War. But the aeroplanes before that had been quite, quite challenging to fly. And the Lightning, for example, we lost aeroplanes regularly. So you had a feeling that the aeroplane was actually looking after you. But it was just, it just had that feel. It just had that look. It was functional. It did what it was supposed to do. I should also add that when I first started flying it, and I first flew in 1975 on the Phantom, it was the best, our own British version was the best air defence aeroplane in Europe.
Yep.
Had a good radar, it had a look-down, shoot-down capability, it had comprehensive weapons, all-aspect weapons. It was just good at what it did, even better than the American aeroplanes at the time. So you felt as though you were in an aeroplane that was worthy of its reputation.
We'll come on to talk a little bit about RAF Germany in a while, but I guess
sure.
at that period of time, when there was a whole multitude of different types, you know, all in that airspace on a day-to-day basis, you probably sort of felt like king of the hill, didn't you?
I think by the time I got to Germany, perhaps we were sort of, you know, we're a bit sort of like the Duke of York, probably on the way back down again, I think, but... But certainly my first tour in UK, then we were very much top of the pile. Nobody else. All the other, for example, the American F-4 that was flying at the time had a pulse-only radar. So it was good at medium level, but not good at low level. So I would say if you were looking for a pinnacle, and people that came later than me might disagree, but I would say probably about 1980 was when the Brit Phantom was at its height.
Okay. You're a navigator.
Mm.
This wonderful... term that we still use to this day, really, I think, to some extent for the Royal Air Force.
Yes, but didn't do much navigation.
Exactly. your role was far more than telling the chap in the front which direction to turn. Just tell us a little bit about what your role was. You were fresh training as well into the F4, weren't you, as well?
I was, and the training didn't equip you to sit in the back of a Phantom at all. You know, it was very biased towards the Vulcan, the large V-Force type operation. You know, sitting plotting in the back of a Dominie, you know, pointing backwards was the training. And the only thing we got to prepare us was about, I got the first lead-in course for the Phantom, and I got 24 hours on a Jet Provost, basically lines on charts, you know, visual navigation through the low flying areas. There was no radar lead-in other than sitting for 10 hours in the back of a Hastings watching a Vulcan radar, which again didn't prepare you at all. So you really went into the Phantom absolutely cold. But that said, there wasn't much navigation to do. The Mark II version, the FGR-2 that I flew, actually had an inertial navigation system in the back seat, which would give you a range and a bearing to various navigation points. So for once, you had a latitude and longitude in the cockpit, and you could point at anywhere that you wanted to go. So, you know, getting around wasn't as difficult as it had been in the past. So my role was, and we all resisted it, but really I was a weapons systems operator. And later on the Air Force actually reclassified navigators as WISOs. But we in the Air Force were quite fiercely protective of the navigator brevet, so that was my title. Funnily enough, when we were flogging around the low-flying areas, it was actually the pilot in the front that was doing the navigation. Okay. And it was only the more complex routes where we sort of helped out, you know, if it was an unusual route going somewhere different. So what was my role on a day-to-day basis? Well, the principal thing was the radar. And it was a very comprehensive, complex radar system operated by three bits of kit, basically, in the back cockpit. There was a radar display scope, which had a camera on top so that you could record everything that went on. There was a navigator hand controller on the right-hand side, which, with a thumb wheel on there, would move the scanner up and down.
Obviously, Dave, very briefly, sure. for nobody else will be able to see. You've actually got your video on, so I can see you at the moment. And right. You're actually, like, it's like you're sitting in the cockpit. You've just reached down for your controller, haven't you?
The thumb was going there. You're
sorry,
absolutely right.
Sorry, carry on.
Yeah. This thing, and actually, I still have the hand controller from one of the aeroplanes, but it was a bit like an original computer game. You know, the blip came up on the radar display. You could move a little acquisition marker around the display and squeeze a trigger. Once you squeezed that, then the radar would lock and track automatically, and that meant you could fire a semi-active missile, the Sparrow, and subsequently the Skyflash. The third part of the equipment was the radar control panel, and that sat down on the left-hand side by your left knee. And this had various operating modes, the pulse Doppler, the pulse, the mapping modes, and what have you, and various range scales and other selectors, and including things like electronic countermeasures modes. So using those three bits of equipment, you operated the scanner in front of you, you know, and found the target. And then once you'd found it, you set up an intercept profile and gave commands to the pilot to fly, headings, heights, speeds, the amount of angular bank, the pull if you needed a particular, you know, 4G pull or whatever. And by talking the pilot on, you got him into a position where he could launch a weapon before you saw the target. So the radar was the principal piece of equipment in the back. As the Phantom developed in British service, we added extra little bits of kit. There was a radar warning receiver built by Marconi, and this thing, if another radar illuminated you, it would flash a signal on its little display tube. By looking at that signal, you could identify the threat band. So, for example, a fish bed was a J-band signal, and a particular vector would come up on the tube, and then various other sequences of lights on the panel would allow you to identify that. And in your headphones, in the old bone dome there, you'd get little bleeps and squeaks, and by listening to that, you could hear the raw signal in the ether, and you could identify it from that as well. So you knew what was coming at you for the first time, which was really helpful. In addition to that, over the years, we added various things. We never got an active jammer on the Phantom, but we did have a chaff and flare system. It was the American system, the ALE-40, and dispensers mounted on the side of the inner wing pylons. You could mount sort of either chaff cartridges or flare cartridges within those dispensers, and you had little selectors to set up sequences of how they deployed, and a dispense button in the front and the back cockpit. So at any time you were threatened by another aircraft, you could dispense chaff and flares to try and counter the incoming missile. Those were the principal things that I did in the back. And as I said, very little navigation other than operating and setting up the inertial in the back.
And just a note for anyone that's wondering, if you look back at archive pictures, you can actually tell very easily which aircraft had the radar warning receiver fitted, can't you? That was a very obvious modification.
And only on the Brit Phantom. That was unique to our aeroplanes. And if you look at the fin cap of a British Phantom, it has a big square top on it. And basically the front and back of that square cap had two antennas mounted looking forwards and backwards. So you didn't have terribly good coverage on the side, on the beam, but you did have very good coverage fore and aft, and it was very accurate, actually, to within a couple of 5 degrees. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned the fish bed there. That, of course, was the NATO call sign for the MiG-21.
It was.
And that leads us quite nicely on to maybe a bit of context here in terms of what was happening in the world at the time that you were sat in the back of a Phantom, because it was a very different place to what it...
Very different indeed. The Iron Curtain, or the inner German border, as it was called, was a definite line on the map. Anybody who's looked at the old Cold War pictures, you would see a very heavily fortified boundary, watchtowers, cleared mine strips, dogs, armed guards. Really, sadly, to keep the East Germans in, not to keep us out. But it was a very clear division between the two blocks, NATO on one side, the Warsaw Pact on the other, which were the old satellite nations as well as Russia and some of the former communist states. So it was very much them and us. You felt that way. It was a daily thing, certainly in Germany when I was there. It was the ever-present division. We were, I think perhaps in many ways, we were safer, although we've all read the nuclear scares of, 2 seconds to button press and what have you. But it was, in many ways, it was a good leveller, because I think governments were very wary of doing something controversial, because Russia might have reacted quite badly. The Warsaw Pact might have reacted quite badly. So in many ways, we were safer than we are now. It's a much more unpredictable world now. But the atmosphere on a NATO flying base was completely different to you'll see now. If you went down to Coningsby today, you'd actually see a base that looks, people are walking around, nice shirt sleeves and what have you. Cold War flying was an exercise probably once a week, maybe twice a month, something like that. The Hooter would go at 4 o'clock in the morning. You would run in, you would put your nuclear biological chemical suit on, and you'd spend a lot of the time contemplating a chemical war. Tin hats, everything painted green. It was quite a drab place when the Hooter went. So the feel about a flying station was completely different to you'll see now.
The vision, I guess, or in terms of where the Phantom would have fitted in was, that you guys would have been launching to sort of hold back the hordes of Soviet bombers as they approached the UK. Do you think?
Yeah, without a doubt. I was under no illusions that given certain circumstances they would roll over the border. And let me answer your questions in two ways. I think the UK situation was a lot different to the Germany situation. And taking the Germany situation first, we expected massive armoured assault through the Fulda Gap, and then probably on two fronts down the inner German border. We expected a very quick push across the forward airspace. So bases like Gütersloh, we didn't expect to last 2 minutes. The Harriers would have deployed out into the field. They would probably have slowly worked backwards, and the forward area would probably have fallen quite quickly. We were at the back at Wildenrath. We were 20 minutes behind the border flying time. We figured we'd have a little bit longer, but we only had 22 jets. Therefore, attrition would have been high. Therefore, we would probably have expected to be the first line of defence and not to last too long. Personally, I expected we would last about a week, if that, before it became completely untenable. Our thought then was we would probably roll back to the UK. The concepts at the time were that the Soviets would roll over Western Germany and be at the Channel ports in 5 days. And there is absolutely no doubt if their logistics chains held up, they could have done that quite happily. So it was a very tense atmosphere in Germany at the time, and we thought we were under threat, without a doubt. Step back to UK to answer the second part of your question. A lot different. As you rightly said earlier, we would have faced hordes of Soviet bombers, the Bears, the Bisons, the Badgers, and latterly the Backfires. And it would have been a medium-level war rather than a low-level war over the North Sea, countering Soviet long-range bombers, probably firing standoff missiles. So the UK system was, it had a layered defence, missiles right at the back, inner caps probably mounted by Lightnings with their shorter range and less missiles, middle caps and outer caps mounted by Phantoms with 8 missiles and a gun if needed, or a centerline tank to give extra range, plus tankers. Bear in mind, in those days, it was very heavily the ground environment, UK ground-based radars. The Shackleton was not very good as an airborne early warning platform. Latterly, the E3 was. So what you have is this layered defence, and the idea of the middle caps was to catch the manned bomber that was coming in to either take pictures or to drop conventional bombs. The outer caps were there to try and catch the long-range missile shooters before they managed to get their missiles in the air. And bear in mind, these missiles could have been nuclear-armed. They were certainly long-range, and they were certainly targeted at our military installations and our ports and cities. Maybe not cities, ports, certainly. So that was the concept, you know, to try and catch people a lot farther out. And we expected there to be heavy electronic warfare, heavy jamming, heavy comms jamming, and the like. So two entirely different battles between the UK and Germany.
It's actually quite chilling to sit here, you know, on this lovely sunny spring morning in the UK and think about that. It's you know, for anyone listening who's you know, who maybe didn't grow up or didn't live through that, it's you know, we don't live in a perfect world, Dave, do we? Far from it. But actually, at least we're maybe not sitting here thinking that something like that might happen at any given moment.
And it always worries us, you know, you get to things like Putin starting to saber rattle, you know, and there is that sort of background feel of, ooh, this sounds a little bit Cold War. But perhaps the most chilling aspect of it, though, was that every exercise, both UK and Germany, ended up with a nuclear phase. We were expecting to be hit by nuclear weapons. There was a thing called a survival scramble, where aeroplanes launched into the air. You got every serviceable aeroplane airborne, went out to essentially a holding combat air patrol in the North Sea and waited until that nuclear attack had finished. And hopefully there was then somewhere to come back to. Now, that was chilling.
And presumably your expectation of potentially having somewhere to go back to was quite low, I would imagine.
Indeed. And I think places like Coningsby, Binbrook and what have you would have been the prime targets, I would expect, to try and extract attrition on the UK Air Defence Forces.
I guess the other thing that is very interesting, and I know because you and I have talked about this before, is that on a day-to-day basis, particularly when you're flying in Germany, this wasn't just a concept, was it? This was very real, and there were lots of games of sort of cat and mouse that went on around that border that you've talked about. And some of those, you know, is it fair to say that notched the tension up a little bit in a very real term?
It did, and I told one of the stories in my first book, Phantom in Focus, and we sat quick reaction alert, and we were on 5 minutes readiness, 24 hours of the day, 7 days a week, and on one occasion we were launched for a border patrol, and that was quite regular. You know, we'd go and run up and down the border, particularly on a nice blue day, and just show a presence. This one particular occasion, we launched and we headed up to towards Hanover, which was at the top end of the inner German border. As we tracked over there, our TACAN, the Tactical Air Navigation System, a radio beacon aid that we had in the cockpit, was showing firmly to the east. This thing had been, it was called Mekoning, and the Soviets had attacked our particular beacon and were giving us false indications, and our position looked as though we were 30 miles away from where we were. Had we gone to that position of the TACAN, we would have been over East German airspace. So they were hoping to lure us across the border and make an incident out of it. It got worse, actually, because as we came back south, there was a, on the inner German border, there was a very distinctive sort of kick in the border, and the border extended well into Western Germany, sort of, you know, in terms of a north-south line.
Yeah.
We were heading south towards that particular jink in the border, and suddenly there was very loud music on the radio frequency. Now, bear in mind, you were under positive radar control in the air defense interception zone, which was the little zone right next to the border. And we were expecting a call from our controller to turn onto 240 or 270 away from the border. And basically, as we were expecting that call, the rock music sort of blasted out the frequency. Yeah, call. So being good chaps and looking down on the ground and seeing this big scar on the ground, we turned onto west and then switched our secondary frequency and re-established control. But again, it was they first of all tried to jam our TACAN, they secondly tried to get us to infringe airspace on this little nick in the border, and failed. So we had another incident of this with more music, more noise on the frequency. So eventually we were told to go home, and you know, we had a debrief. And subsequently it turned out they showed us the systems on the ground that had been jamming us. They showed us what had happened and who'd been in control of it. And more importantly, there was a MiG on the other side of the border that had been launched specifically to be there in case we did infringe on the airspace. So, yes, it was a constant battle, a constant sort of cat-and-mouse game of, you know, if we can screw you around, we will.
Did you know that the first G-suit for British pilots was essentially a chest-high pair of fisherman's waders which were filled with 2 gallons of water? The water automatically squeezed the pilot's legs as positive G was applied. Did you also know that the Islamic Republic of Iran Air Force's oldest McDonnell Douglas F-4D Phantom is set to clock up more than 70 years in service, having been delivered in 1968 and now subject to life extension programs taking it to 2040? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
Wow. Incredible stuff. And I mean, bringing things forward to the present day, you just mentioned Phantom in Focus, that and many other stories were in your first book, and you've now turned into what David can only describe as being a prolific author, I think.
I've been tapping away.
so we'll come on to a couple of the others in a second, but it started with Phantom in Focus. Is that, and I mean, you're obviously a photographer as well. We must mention that. Lots of your own pictures in there. Is that something that you always felt you wanted to do?
I think it was more a case of capturing the experiences. You know, I tried to carry my camera when I could in the cockpit, although it was difficult, you know, to carry quite a bulky camera. There was nowhere to store it in a Phantom, so you kind of ended up strapping it on the in front of you on the sort of you know, the rack in front there. But I did carry it whenever possible, and I did if I went on detachment or anything like that, take it along with me. So I never tried to set up specific sorties or photographic events, with one or two exceptions. But if there was a good picture, I'd snap away, and I did regularly. So the pictures were the basis of Phantom in Focus as a first book. But luckily, I kept on doing it over the years, although there were some fairly long gaps, particularly when I was an instructor, where there, you know, the photographic record is a bit slim. but after that, I chose the next two books were parts of my life, and one was Fighters Over the Falklands, which was very much focused on how we operated down south, both on the Phantom and on the Tornado F3. And then the one that's just come out, Tornado F3 in Focus, I tried to sort of emulate Phantom in Focus in some ways in terms of format. But I guess the content of Tornado F3 in Focus is a little bit more towards the politics of the aeroplane, the development, the modification states. Of course, the epic Fox Hunter saga of the early days, where it wasn't really working very well. So it's a little bit more the background to the aeroplane than Phantom, which was more about what went on in the cockpit, you know.
And we must just expand on that slightly, Dave. Let's give the F3 every opportunity to stand up for itself.
Yeah.
If you're firmly in the Phantom camp, I think you're probably still there to this day, saying that the F4 was replaced by an aircraft that, you know, wasn't as capable or as charismatic, you know, and actually in terms of capability, charisma doesn't really come into it, but it's still a drum that people beat. And yes, there were problems with the F3, but the F3 did, and the full story is in the book, but it did actually turn into an incredibly capable aircraft, didn't it?
And I do hope I've tried to lay those myths to rest in the book. When it first came into service, undoubtedly it didn't work. It was underdeveloped. It was undertested. So we had a basket case on day one. It really didn't work at all. So all those, but for the catch is, its reputation was based on that. And I think people don't think it ever developed beyond that stage. And certainly the crew room banter was along those lines.
Yeah.
Now, what happened, and because of my positions, I was in the Ministry of Defence on two occasions, very closely involved with the F3 and the developments and the modifications. I've been able to tell the story from an insider perspective. And it, without a doubt, it developed, and it developed extremely well. And the aircraft that went out of service was arguably the most capable aeroplane of its time. And I would say that including things like the F-15. In its beyond visual range role, it had superb situation awareness with the data links it had on board. By then, the Fox Hunter developed to stage 3 standard. And bear in mind that stage 1 didn't come in until 1990, so stage 3 standard. And it had defensive aids and various other modifications fitted that made it an extremely capable aeroplane. And I'm very jealous of the crews that got to fly the final standard, because it must have been really good. The bit that never, the icing on the cake that never really came, was it never had a helmet-mounted sight, which would have made it fearsome in combat. It didn't have certain visual acquisition systems, which even the Phantom had, you know, had a simple rifle scope, for example. So there were a few things that were never quite there. It never got fitted with big engines like the EJ-200, although that was looked at but never implemented. So the final icing was never there, but it was without doubt a very capable aeroplane. And some of the stuff that you see online is just not true, you know.
Okay, well that's our little bit of F3 stuck up for today. Yeah. Before we go, let's just talk about fiction.
Yeah.
Because certainly your Cold War experiences, not only have you managed to, and I think we should all be very grateful that you've put your own personal experiences down in writing, because I think that, you know, that's brilliant to get that history saved, but you've also translated that to a couple of works of fiction as well. Tell us about that.
I'm up to 3 now. Yeah. Funny enough, the Defector, which was my first work of fiction I wrote many years ago, about 10 years ago, maybe even more. And that tracked a sort of a fictional Soviet fighter pilot defecting to the West, bringing his Su-27 Flanker with him. I like to say that all the books on the fiction side, they're faction. So I try to base it, I mean, Defector was based at Wildenrath, so I try to, you know, talk about Wildenrath as it was. Certainly the Phantom, all the descriptions of it, the weapon systems, what happens in the cockpit and all that, all the kind of stuff that I describe is based on fact. Obviously, the actual storyline is pure fiction, and but hopefully it adds to the way the story's told. I've produced 3 so far. Defector was the first, with this story of the SU-27, and then I followed up quite recently with one called Maverick, which is based in the Falkland Islands. It's about an Argentinian A4 pilot that decides to have a go at the Falklands post-conflict.
Okay.
And basically, he makes an attack across the water through the defended airspace against Port Stanley, and it's the story about how that, you know, that attack develops and what happens afterwards. And then the third one, literally hot off the press, I've just released it this last week, is called Deception, and that's based in the Middle East. And there was a situation in about 1982-83, and it was called, wonderful name, Operation Pulsator. And this was a formation of Buccaneers and Phantoms that were deployed from RAF Akrotiri in Cyprus, and they were sent on a show of force across the Lebanon. I use that as the basis, but the story is basically a hostage that's taken in Beirut, and this combined air operation is mounted to try and release the hostage from captivity. And I based that sort of story on the Amiens raid of World War II, where
okay.
they dropped the sort of prison walls using bombs and what have you. So it's all the story around that. And throughout the three novels, it's the same Phantom crew that that do their thing and normally come home for tea and medals. And I've tried to keep a common theme, and they appear on all three. So yeah, and it's great fun writing the fiction because, of course, you're allowed to, although it's based in fact, you're allowed to sort of invent things and do stuff that never happened nor could happen.
I know that they are doing and have all done very well. Something you and I have touched upon chatting, and I know that Dale Brown has come up on the podcast before because of Flight of the Old Dog and stuff like that, but with him and sort of Stephen Koontz, even Tom Clancy, we seem to have had a lot more of that before. And, you know, I guess there's a little gap that you're filling now. It just doesn't seem to be so much of that around anymore.
Well, I'm hoping, but surprisingly, the modern literary world doesn't seem to want that sort of, you know, the aviation thriller, which is surprising. So I've gone ahead and just filled the gap myself. And, I certainly wouldn't put myself in the same category as those wonderful authors that you've just mentioned. But hopefully, you know, the sort of Andy McNab style of, put the reader there, that's what I'm striving for. And the people that are reading them enjoy them, and they're sitting high in their categories on Amazon at the minute. So,
and is there more on the way?
Say again?
More on the way?
Yes. There's two more factual ones coming. There's one called Tornado in Pictures, which is actually a showcase for a chap called Darren Willman. And Darren is an aviation photographer, does some wonderful work, and basically the publisher asked me just to add some context to it. So what I've tried to do is a little bit of description. It'll cover all the marks of Tornado, but I've tried to add a little bit of aircrew value added of, and for example, one linking passage. I talked about a fictional training sortie between some Tornado F3s getting airborne from Coningsby, Tornado GR1s getting airborne from Marham, and how they would interact as they went around a typical training sortie. That's so fantastic. That kind of thing. But it's principally the pictures. I'm working on that's called Operational Test Honing the Edge. So I'll look in there at my sort of operational test experience of how we tested aeroplanes, what we did, how we did it, and where we went to do it. And that'll be out at the end of the year. And another novel, working on another novel, that's called Provocation. And that's going to look at a Berlin Corridor type scenario. So we used to fly exercises called the Bold Series, Bold Encounter, Bold Pointer.
Yeah.
And that corridors, we put fighter aeroplanes in to escort a transport down the corridor and, that kind of scenario. And this the latest novel will explore that sort of, you know, the tensions and the what happens when the force sort of penetrates the corridor and bad guys coming from the other side and that kind of thing. So
am I right in saying that the testing book is written in conjunction with somebody who's also got some very interesting tales to tell?
Yes. Yeah, I'm co-authoring the testing book with David Lewis, who is a very experienced weapons instructor both on the Phantom and the Tornado F3. Then latterly, he was a test navigator for British Aerospace Systems up at Wharton. Flew both the Tornado F3 and the GR4. So very experienced. We both joined the Air Force at the same time. But
well, Dave, thank you so much for joining us. It's always good fun to talk to you, and I'm sure everyone's going to enjoy listening. And we might, you know, there'll probably be a few questions. And I know that you're sort of readily available on Facebook and groups and things like that. And so, and we can put the links to some of those groups for the F4 and the Tornado in the show notes for this episode, and also tell people where they can get hold of all the wonderful books if indeed they haven't read them already. So thank you so much for joining us. We'll speak to you again soon.
You too, Gareth.
Thanks, Dave.
Take care.
Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our program and broaden its reach. You can also review the program and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.